Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture and to remind viewers that entertainment is not mindless.
Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 113, with guests J.R. Forresteros, regular of the show and co-host of the Storymen podcast, and for the first time ever, M.J. Smith from the Before and After show. So listen up, because we've got a really great show for you. On this episode, we talk the birth of a nation and systemic injustice. But the beginning of a conversation, a very long conversation, would involve talking about The Birth of a Nation, the 2016 film by Nate Parker, also starring Nate Parker, directed by Nate Parker. The interesting thing about this film is it is a film that does what so many award-winning type films do, which is come out in a limited release earlier in the year, and we don't get to see it until it's bought by a bigger company and put out or distributed more widely. Which is why this premiered at Sundance in January and won the Audience Award and the Grand Jury Prize at the Sundance Film Festival, which made everyone super excited to see it, including myself. Heck, the trailer alone had enough scripture references and lines that I'm like, is this like an actual movie that people were going to watch? The trailer looked good. It looked intense and thoughtful. And now it's actually come to theaters. Fortunately, I know I was able to see this a couple weeks back. Obviously, you guys have seen it. And it has actually hit a wall of negative feedback a little bit before it was released, and now that it's come out. And so it's interesting to see. I think Rotten Tomatoes has it around 70%, maybe. It's interesting to see the blowback for Nate Parker himself for some things that he was involved in. It's interesting to see the historical blowback of people who say, like, this isn't how this happened at all. The Nat Turner Rebellion that the film is supposedly based on. But I think people who don't know either of those two things, don't know the history behind it, and don't know the behind the scenes or the personal history that Nate Parker has, they've fairly enjoyed it.
Well, and I think we run into this with a lot of filmmakers, right? Like Woody Allen films. Mm-hmm. When you disagree with the personal, like the individual behind the film, and, mm-hmm. and not with anything in the film, not with the text, so to speak, but with the character of the person making the film, whether they're the director, the actor, maybe even the writer, whatever. How important is that, you know? And with Nate Parker, you know, it's alleged that he sexually assaulted a woman, when he was in college. I think he was 19, and he was acquitted of it in court. And about 12 years ago, she committed suicide.
I think it was like four. It was in 2012.
It was more recent. Yeah. Oh, in 2012. Yeah. Okay. Yes. Sorry. He, you know, when he was asked about it, he brushed it off and has since, mm-hmm. walked that back and apologized. But I don't know, like for you, I'm curious. I've wrestled a lot with all of that, and I've read some of his statements and some of that. What do you do with someone who you, again, maybe might find personally reprehensible, but who makes compelling art? Hacksaw Ridge, Mel Gibson's new film's getting ready to come out. Mm-hmm. Same thing.
Yeah.
Right? Dude's like a complete Looney Tune, probably basically a neo-Nazi. But like, he makes really good movies a lot of times.
Or at least, really compelling films too.
Yeah.
So I think so. We've talked about this briefly on the podcast, and I actually have to remember which episode it was. But I know we've talked about like what happens off screen, how much does it affect what you watch on screen. And so, JR, you indirectly raised the question, but so I've already talked about it. I'm interested where you land, MJ, on this, because I have never had the privilege of having you on the show, so I'm not sure where you land on a lot of things. But I know that you do a lot of reviews, and you get to see a lot of things, so I'm curious.
Yeah, this is actually a conversation that I have kind of a lot, you know, with it being October and spooky times for movies. A big hole in my watch list has been Rosemary's Baby. It's not a movie I've ever seen. And the other day, my wife and I were like, let's watch that. And then I started thinking about Roman Polanski, someone in a similar situation to a Woody Allen or a Nate Parker. And I was like, I don't know. I tend, like, I've tried watching a handful of Roman Polanski movies. One, I don't find them particularly compelling. And two, there's, you know, his complicated backstory with the allegations of statutory rape, which he has acknowledged and admitted guilt for, but also fled the country so he wouldn't be charged for them. And then with Woody Allen, you know, he's just had an Amazon series pop up, and Blue Jasmine came out right. I saw that when it came out, and it was right around that time that, you know, the allegations of him molesting his daughter came around. And yeah, it's hard to land on that kind of stuff because they are capable of making compelling art. Or even, you know, to take it even further into probably the reason I'm on this episode specifically, when the art has a terrible message, but the art is compelling, which is the case with the movie Birth of a Nation takes its name from, Birth of a Nation from 1915, the 3.5 hour race, like KKK propaganda film. Like that's the only way you can frame that movie is as KKK propaganda. It's really good. So
technically, you're saying it's really good technically.
Yeah, it's really compelling. The battle scenes are incredible. Mm-hmm. It's a well-made movie. It's exceedingly
well-made. Yeah, it's excellent filmmaking. Right. Yeah, yes. Yeah.
And so you can't discredit that. You can't. If it's objectively well done, you have to give credit where credit is due. And with someone like Nate Parker, I don't know that this movie's exceptionally well made.
So I'm guessing, or based on what you're saying, it sounds like you don't have like a line. Like you can put two columns up on a chalkboard and say, this is the line that needs to be crossed for me to outweigh personal personal failings to enjoy art. It's like fluid to you based on what I'm hearing, right?
Kind of. It's just something that I'm constantly wrestling with because I made the decision to not watch Rosemary's Baby based on Roman Polanski as a person.
So what does that do for you? Well, like, do you feel like you're like, haha, Roman Polanski, that's, you know, $3 that you don't have now. Like,
Because the movie's on Amazon Prime and I piggyback off my father-in-law's Amazon Prime. So it would have cost me nothing to watch the movie. It was more driven by morality that day. And I don't want to say like my morality's constantly relative like that, but it's that art versus artist comparison it's something I always go back and forth on. That is definitely an issue where I look at it. And, you know, Rosemary's Baby does have historical significance in horror movies. And I've already watched 1915 Birth of a Nation, which is way more foul, I would say, in its messaging. Mm-hmm. I don't think Rosemary's Baby is, as far as the actual text of the movie. And so now it's one of those things where it's like, well, then why would I not watch it? So it's I don't know. I'm constantly struggling with trying to find the right answer for it.
Mm. So
if there is
one. Yeah. So JR, I'm kind of curious where you land as well, because I see this setting up as a no-win scenario for the viewer, because like I said, we're not really, we talked about this with Orson Scott Card when Ender's Game came out. You know, Orson Scott Card saying some things that people would probably agree with, but, you know, personally, some things that I did not find very tasteful. And
charitable and kind.
Yeah, terribly unkind. So you're not really taking that many dollars out of his pocket by not seeing the movie. Is the concern more that you're supporting someone who is imperfect or is doing bad things financially? Or do you think there's actually also the possibility that if someone's willing to do that, something in their art is going to affect you on a deeper level?
I honestly, you know, we did a Storyman episode back when the Bill Cosby thing broke about this exact issue. Right. Because it's the same stuff. Can you even watch the Cosby? Like, we've taken Cosby Show off the air.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it was up until, you know, a year ago, it was one of the most beloved sitcoms in history and hailed as a landmark for African-American actors and African-American centric shows because it was such a such like a middle class depiction of black people. They weren't in a ghetto. It wasn't black exploitation, blah, blah, blah. Like, it was so important. And then now it's like we can't even put it on our televisions, you know. So we had that conversation and I am beginning to think that maybe some of our reluctance to engage art that has such very public moral failings attached to it, maybe is more about our own inability to admit that we're all complicit in these kinds of things. For instance, I'm not making any kind of apology for Nate Parker. I don't know what happened. I wasn't there. I haven't looked at all of the case files or any of that. I do know that almost never is it the case that women invent allegations of sexual violence. So take that for what you will.
Yeah.
But I will also say, like, one of the things that Parker talked about in his kind of apology was what it's like to grow up as a young black man and how you're taught to view women and speak to women, and that he is now teaching his sons to be different. And I think that's in no way excuses or condones whatever probably happened. But I think we also have to acknowledge, and this gets into the whole Black Lives Matter movement, which is something that the film was very much commenting on, right? Which is that there are systemic injustices in our country, and it is so easy for us to sit on our couches or behind our computer screens or on our phones and click like or unfollow someone or, you know, tweet a encouragement or a criticism or whatever and feel like we've either criticized who we think needs to be criticized or supported who we need to support, and we haven't done anything to address the systemic injustices. And so I think sometimes when we express this vocal moral outrage over people like Nate Parker, who probably made some criminal decisions towards women, we would rather do that and feel good about ourselves than have an honest conversation about how we are at best silent in the face of rape culture and the way women are exploited. You know what I mean? Like, because we don't want to think about that. And so we'd rather point at someone who has an obvious public, I've never done anything like that. So I can feel good about myself because I can feel bad about him. And if I point it out over there, then I have to look at the fact that even though I haven't done what he's done, there've been plenty of times I've laughed at a sexist joke or have accepted a speaking position at a conference without checking to see if there were females represented in the speaking lineups, or, you know, just in other ways, exercised my privilege as a male or in some way passively or actively contributed to rape culture. And so, yeah, I don't know. Like, that's probably a convoluted answer to that question, but.
Well, no, I think
that's a convoluted question.
Yeah. I have a hard time saying, like, I haven't watched a Woody Allen movie since I kind of figured out what a sleazebag he is.
Yeah.
But if one of his movies got a lot of Oscar buzz, I'm not sure I wouldn't watch it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, okay. So let me try to dig down deep. And I realize that you guys may have not given this a lot of intense thought, but kind of just had a knee-jerk reaction. But I'm guessing that's where most people have come from. So you're saying that you learned what a kind of skis bag Woody Allen is, and that made you say, well, I'm not going to watch his stuff. Like I said, what do you think you're hoping that accomplishes? Like, does it, like I said, does it make you not interested in his art? Does it make you feel like you just don't want to be associated with things that like might...
It's hard for me to watch Bill Cosby stand up now.
Yes, I agree. I actually bought one of his stand-up albums the week before all this hit the news. I bought it at a used bookstore and I was like, this is a really good price. I love this album. I grew up listening to it. I'm going to buy it on vinyl, used, and got home. And then a week later, all this hit the news and I ended up getting rid of the album in the move. And even when I was getting rid of the album, I was like, do I re-donate this or do I just toss it?
Yeah.
And I ended up just tossing it because I was like, I don't know if I can... I don't know. And I did the same thing with, you know, a group of books from some people who I did, some specifically Christian authors who I at one time was in their camp and did kind of agree with theologically speaking, and then ended up not agreeing with them. And
we all know you're talking about Rob Bell. OK,
that was one of them. That was one of us. Definitely. And so it was one of those things where it's like, well, I know this person would enjoy it if I gave them those books. Do I really want to give them that, though? And I ended up not.
Well, so that's interesting because since you have indirectly and I have called out the name, I think actually Rob Bell's a good example for Christians, because mm-hmm. this is a conversation that I have had like in real life with a number of people about, hey, so someone says something that is not theologically sound or theologically divisive, or maybe they even go as far as saying something that is legitimately, which is probably a lot less the case, heretical. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Does that automatically negate everything else they say? Because I'm, you know, having a conversation with an older man that I really respect, and I say, hey, we should both read. I mean, this is probably about 8 or 9 years ago. I'm like, hey, have you, you know, read this book by Rob Bell? And he goes, I haven't really heard of this guy. It's like, he's got lots of great ideas. He's got lots of way of engaging, especially with non-Christians, lots of ways mm-hmm. of conveying the message and ideas that you find in the Bible in a way that I have not particularly heard before. Let's read this book together. And he said, okay, well, let's do this. And it wasn't a week later, he came back. After not actually having read the book, he actually went online and read about people who have read the book and had problems with it and said, he says this in the book. Do you think this is true? And I was like, well, no. But does that mean that nothing else in the book is worthwhile? And he's like, well, if he's not right about every single thing, then why would we even spend our time considering anything he has to say? And that to me is that to me is problematic, because it would mean that all of us, you know, especially, you know, JR, in your situation where you're a pastor, if you ever said anything wrong, then nothing you ever say has any value.
I can guarantee you that not everything in my new book is right.
Yeah,
I don't know. Like, I don't know what's not right. I think it's all right. Uh-huh. But I can pretty much guarantee you 15 years from now, I'm looking at look back and be like, what a dummy. Like,
so
give me a break.
Well, like, yeah.
Or the other option is that at almost 36 years old, I cracked it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're the first person that ever got everything right. Yep. Like,
you're Neo. And,
I mean, yeah, exactly. Right. Like, that's unlikely. So, yeah, like that's just like a really immature, I'm sorry, apologize to your friend, but like that's a really immature attitude.
Okay, so I would agree generally, but so what I set this whole story up to kind of bring it back to what we're talking about. Like, is there not a correlation between, again, the questionable artist and the art they're making? So, I mean, people think that Woody Allen is a great filmmaker. I mean,
some of Woody Allen's films are great. I mean, I honestly think Midnight in Paris is a phenomenal film.
So good. should we say, hey, Woody Allen is terrible, but even if some of that terrible seeps through, there's enough good here that we can actually pull something out of it and be like, look, Woody Allen is a dummy, you know, but this art that he is making is just like anybody else's art. And I'm sort of playing devil's advocate because I don't 100% agree with myself right now.
Well, okay, so let me switch the metaphor a little bit.
Okay.
Because it's not a question of is, you know, 1% of Woody Allen's, is there like one scene of pedophilia and the rest of it's like a good film?
Mm-hmm.
And we're like, ooh, which is kind of the theology example, right? Like, they make a couple of iffy statements. It's more like, so here's this person that wrote this book. It was actually, I don't know if y'all know John Howard Yoder, but he's very influential ethicist and big friends with Stanley Hauerwas. They wrote Resident Aliens together, which is a hugely influential book. He's passed, and it's come out since he's died that he like sexually abused some of his graduate students while he was writing these books that are hugely influential, that have changed the way lots of people understand Christianity and see God and have framed the way people understand their faith in positive, good ways.
Yeah, I mean, to build off of that and kind of bring it back into film and specifically the original Birth of a Nation, I did a lot of research. We covered it. I wrote a thing for Real World Theology on Birth of a Nation, and I also covered it on my own podcast. And I did a lot of research on D.W. Griffith and the movie. And, you know, he was the grandson of, or the son of, a Confederate colonel. And his follow-up movie was this movie Intolerance, which was four stories of intolerance throughout the ages, one of them being a Christ story, actually. And a lot of people thought it was him trying to atone for the message of Birth of a Nation, saying like, oh, hey, I'm sorry, you know, here, let me make this thing that's about intolerance being acted on people. That wasn't it at all. His intent with making Intolerance was he was the one who the intolerance was being put upon. So in those stories of intolerance, he's Jesus. He's the French people who are being oppressed, you know, because he expressed an unpopular opinion with Birth of a Nation.
He's like the white person today that's saying like, hey, that's racist against white people.
Well, yeah, he's the white suburban Christian who thinks that Christianity's being like, he's being like oppressed and persecuted for his Christianity because like there is a mosque being built in their city.
Right. Right.
And it's not being, you know, disallowed. The false right. martyr kind of.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, okay. So the thing about.
So this, does that make sense? Like my different, like, no, I think it matters. Because say what you will about Rob Bell, but the dude's like super kind.
Yeah.
Right. Like he's faithful to his wife. He's a great dad.
That
like,
we know of.
Well, sure.
You know what I mean? You heard it here
first. And again, take Mark Driscoll on the flip side. Like, most people at Mars Hill who left Mars Hill, his other Mars Hill, like, they didn't have a problem with his theology and his preaching. It was actually, like, his personal conduct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, he was being abusive. And so, like, I don't know. That's different, I think.
No, I think it's a great metaphor because what you're saying is instead of, like, the content being partially questionable, because I think at least in the way that I presented it, I think it's closer to the horror discussion that we have often had on this, and you know, we'll have again because it's Halloween and stuff, where, you know, do you watch a horror film when lots of it is very kind of questionable, or you know, whatever, because there is truth found in it. I mean, same thing, you know, Game of Thrones, everything else we watch that Christians don't want to watch. So, you know, do you engage that or not? But in the example that you've given, I like it because you're having people saying, well, even though this guy did reprehensible things, we still can't find a fault with the subject, you know, matter that he wrote about. So what do we do with that? Oh, man. So
and that's different. That's different from saying, man, there's some parts of that film that I think have a really toxic message. Mm-hmm. There's other parts that are good. Mm, that's different from like, this is a great film that has a really important message. And the person who made it is like a deeply problematic person.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I think,
I think this film is more of that kind of scenario, right?
Well, I think it goes back to what MJ said at the beginning, at least personal opinion wise, when I finished watching Birth of a Nation, I expected it to be game changing as far as quality of film, but I really did not enjoy it that much for a number of reasons. Though when I usually run across a film like that, I would say, well, maybe we'll just skip this and I'll do a podcast about it. But there's so much to talk about that the film is either trying to addresses poorly, or I think misses the mark on. It's still there's so much here that it's almost worth watching, again, in my personal opinion, just because of the conversations that it's starting, much like the one we've already had, where we haven't even really talked about the film yet. You know,
yeah.
Like, you know, we're 20 some minutes in, and we haven't actually talked about a single really scene in the actual film. So to kind of move us on, realizing that, you know, this is going to be everyone's personal opinion, I will say, answer that outside the podcast. We would love for you guys to, if you have very strong opinions about how artists' art should be viewed separate from their personal lives, we want to have that discussion. Use the Real World Theology Facebook group, you know, use the comment section of the actual podcast, because we're just kind of throwing out ideas and hypotheticals, but I think it's going to be a personal opinion. Where I'd love to move the conversation is addressing still not the film, but the illusion that the film is based on, which is, even the name, The Birth of a Nation, harkens back to, as MJ said, the film Birth of a Nation.
Yeah.
You know? So even the name of the film reminds us of unwelcome or racist things in what it's portraying. So the original Birth of a Nation from D.W. Griffith, MJ, you did have a chance to watch it in its entirety, and I enjoyed kind of going through and watching your reactions to it and how it started out being like, oh, it's not so bad. Oh, it's pretty good. This is surprising. And then it took a dramatic turn. So
yes, it did.
can you give us an idea of what that film was? Because like you've kind of you've danced around it, but I want to hear specifically what that film was, why it was made, and your thoughts kind of like while watching it and then, you know, during watching it and after watching it, because I think that's going to set the stage for what The Birth of a Nation, the 2016 film, is going to kind of allude to.
Yeah, I agree. Hang on one second. Let me pull up a Facebook post and turn the light on in this room. It got dark.
It got cozy.
Okay, so The Birth of a Nation, the D.W. Griffith version, is an adaptation of a book called The Klansman, which is basically about how the South was wronged in the Civil War.
Obviously.
And yeah, clearly. And
do you mean the War of Northern Aggression?
That's right.
Yeah. And they were, you know, they were the real victims there, and they were forced to adhere to these laws that they didn't want to adhere to, which my argument would be the Constitution. It's the Constitution that they didn't want to adhere to.
I can see the quote marks. Like, you know.
Yes. And it just like it goes from that and the War of Northern Aggression, and then the film has a really complicated relationship with Abraham Lincoln, because they view him as this sort of big government guy trying to come in and take him over. And then the Reconstruction period starts happening, and they view him as their best friend, of like, he's our only hope to make it through this and still have kind of a semblance of what the South was. And then he gets assassinated, and they're like, oh no, it's going to be chaos. And their definition of chaos is like, black people are going to be viewed as people. Mm-hmm. And So as a result, this guy gets the idea. They see black people coming into their area, and they're free now. And there's an evil, and he is evil, but the movie goes out of its way to make him evil. Mm-hmm. There's an evil guy, actually mixed race guy. They use the term mulatto, and he comes in to make sure that the statutes of Reconstruction are being implemented correctly, but he ends up taking his power too far and forming a black militia that starts patrolling the streets and starts terrorizing these poor white people. And one of the white people decides, oh, we'll make a anti-black militia, and we'll wear hoods so that we have anonymity, and we can intimidate them because they won't know who we are. And that's the ultimate win of The Birth of a Nation, is the KKK gets formed and they intimidate black people to stay home on election day.
Mm.
And then there's two marriages and it's over. And then the movie ends with Jesus coming to save all the white people.
Hmm. Well, that sounds like a wholesome family film.
Yep.
Take the kids, everyone.
Yeah. So you've already established that the film is incredibly well done.
Oh, it's so much, the pacing is, it all feels so modern. You know, it's silent and 3 hours and 10 minutes, but it's so well paced, and the battle scenes are incredible, and the score is amazing. It was one of the first films that had a fully orchestrated score. Usually it was just a bunch of cues and they allowed for improvisation. But this one was a score start to finish that was supposed to go with this movie, and it works. And yeah, so it's exceedingly well done filmmaking, and you watch it and you see all these techniques that are still being implemented today. You recognize all these trademarks from other directors that have borrowed on it, not because they love the film, but just because he unearthed these building blocks of cinematic form.
Mm. So it's interesting that D.W. Griffith, in his attempt to basically make an apologetic for the South, ends up through cinema, through the power of cinema, through the power of, technically great filmmaking, obviously very unfortunate storytelling or thematics.
Yeah.
He ends up painting this picture of black people as like infiltrating white society, like wanting to do harm to white people, and basically and spinning a narrative that blacks are harmful and violent and criminals. And yes, it basically hasn't left us since, correct?
Yeah.
So then we move to The Birth of a Nation, Nate Parker's film, and it's been getting some flack because it's historically inaccurate. But JR, what I'm curious about is what you saw this film saying almost in response to a film like that, not just that slavery is bad, but what does this film have to say about, the oppression and injustice that blacks have gone throughout the history of America, and how does it present it to us?
Yeah, I've been fascinated by watching the reactions to this film. A friend of mine is a professor who takes his class to Sundance every year, and he saw this with a big group of students and then discussed it afterwards. And he said it wrecked him, so I kind of had some high expectations going in. And I definitely can't speak as a person of color watching this film, mm-hmm. obviously. But what really struck me about the film, and again, you knew this even with the title, as we've already, hinted at several times, is that Parker is making a statement about the reality of where our nation has come from and how our nation got here. And I think as basically the last 2 years of racial strife has shown in our country, we haven't even come close. We being the people in power have not come close to acknowledging the deep, deep, deep injustices that are wound inextricably around the roots of our country, and let alone the fruit that those are bearing in our modern day. And I could not believe how thoroughly this film kept echoing the Black Lives Matter movement again and again and again. And I was, as a white person who would consider myself pretty sympathetic to the Black Lives Matter movement, someone who works hard to acknowledge racial and systemic injustice, even in my preaching at my with my congregation, which is predominantly white, I felt challenged and convicted by the degree to which I hide behind my privilege and not and don't engage these issues. That mainly happened, honestly, through the character of Samuel Turner, the quote unquote good slave master.
Yeah.
And I saw it coming, like, early in the film when we like him so much and like he protects Nat from some of the meaner whites.
Yeah.
Who overreact and all that. And you feel that like swell of pride in him. And I felt that like, man, how lucky is Nat that he has this great. And I was just like, like, that's like the worst thing you could possibly think. And yet it was like, I think it was what he was wanting the film to do, so that the scene, the kind of the last scene before the rebellion really gets serious, when the woman is given to one of his hosts that he's entertaining, you know, it was like, and you could tell he didn't want to do it. He felt so bad about it. But when push came to shove, if he had to choose between his own financial stability and doing what was right, what was clearly right, what everyone on screen could see was clearly right, he chose to protect himself. And that like gut punched me hard. Because I thought about all of the times where I have chosen my own security and stability over justice, over speaking up, over saying something. And I was deeply troubled by that. The film has a lot to say about the effectiveness of violence. We can probably talk about all that later. Yes. But like, that's where I was emotionally. In that film, I could barely process anything else because I was so wrapped up, and I saw myself in Samuel Turner, and that disturbed me, I think, in all of the ways that Nate Parker meant it to disturb me. I hope, anyway.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, and that's the thing. So that's why I'm seeing a divide with how this film is affecting people, because on the one hand, this film lets us have a conversation about, or lets anyone, I think, really have a conversation about the Black Lives Matter movement, about systemic racism and how it was birthed into our culture, you know, hundreds of years ago and hasn't really left. I think it talks about and addresses white privilege today. But then the other half are people who are saying, if you actually read about Nat Turner's rebellion or Nat Turner himself, this film is actually doing him an injustice, because it's not actually telling his story. It's telling a very one-sided version of a very complicated story. Mm-hmm. By leaving out tons of historical inaccuracies. I mean, even though we could agree that the best slave master, or the most kind slave master, which actually Nat Turner's records would actually say that his actual master, Joseph Travis, was a kind master to him. Even the kindest slave master is still a master of slaves.
Yep. They own people.
They own
people. At the end of the day.
So no matter how kind they are, they still own slaves. So what this film does, by being historically inaccurate, to the point where it's actually taken Nat Turner's master and it's made him an easily to get behind, like, we're, as an audience, we're not morally conflicted because his master ends up being a drunk who's making terrible decisions instead of being someone that still needs to be addressed because he is still the owner of people, and simply because he is the owner of people, not because he's a drunk, not because he's giving his friend's wife to his friend to save his own skin, just because he owns people. It's kind of like the idea that in the film, Nat Turner doesn't really get up in arms. The straw that breaks the camel back is watching or seeing his wife having been molested. So
yeah, you know, Mikey, that's you bring that up. Slate has a great article on the historical, like, what's fact and what's fiction. Mm-hmm. And one of the first things they bring up is that as far as we can tell from the historical record, though it is possible that his wife may have been raped on a plantation somewhere, that the rape of black women was not a motivation in Nat Turner's rebellion. Yeah.
Yes.
And so but it was 100% purely his motivation was the scriptures and his own spiritual journey towards liberation. And so especially because of the allegations brought against Nate Parker, that has made the fact that, as you just said, the primary what would you call it? Like the straw that broke the camel's back was these two rapes. And so several critics have pointed out this is a big problem because it's not historical. It was like he chose to tell a story where two women were raped purely so that a man could have the motivation to do what he needed to do.
Yeah.
And also, did you guys see the article that the victim in his case, in Nate Parker's case, his sister, her sister, wrote an article about that.
Oh, wow. And
yeah, I don't remember what side it was on. It was pretty powerful, and the whole article was calling out, like, hey, isn't it a little weird that this guy who has been accused of this is now making the movie where he basically avenges a rape? Mm-hmm. Whereas in real life, there's no real evidence that this happened either way, necessarily.
Yeah.
And certainly it wasn't the motivation for Nat Turner.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. And it definitely was not the inciting incident for Nat Turner's rebellion.
Well, and see, when it does that, it seems like it, historically, I feel like Nat Turner's rebellion should be remembered because it's people who see injustice. Slavery, just as injustice, even from the kindest slave masters, that is enough, particularly based on scripture, to say that this is not justice, this is not right, something needs to be done about it, but this is a distraction. And further,
yeah, like we don't, like you said, we don't need these rapes, we don't need him to be a drunk, all we need is the people, reality of slavery. Yeah. Yeah.
And what it does, it does bring up violence, and there's so many articles. There's been so much written on this that I feel like we can't honestly talk about everything. But I want to mention a couple things, and just kind of let conversation go from there. And that's that when we start getting into the actual historical account of why Nat Turner had this rebellion, we see that it's messier, and Nat Turner is no saint. Mm-hmm. And we see the implications of violence and the effect of violence on both sides, how violence in oppressing an entire people based on the color of their skin or their origin basically has turned and led to more violence, and how that brings, or how religion plays in with that. Because, I mean, we have situations, and like I said, there will be plenty of links in this thing about talking about how the slaves themselves felt justified in killing women and children because of how they were treated. There are stories of, like, when they killed Nat Turner's master, they not only killed Joseph Travis, his actual master, but they killed his wife, his 9-year-old son, and then they realized that they had left one family member alive, which was an infant sleeping in a cradle, so they went in and killed him too. That would have made this movie, I think, sit with us a little heavier, because we would have had to say, what would we have been willing to do? And in this case, they point us to the Bible. And in an interview with Nate Parker, with Alyssa Wilkinson at Christianity Today, you know, he talks about the violence that he sees in the Bible, and then turns around and asks, you know, I ask your readers and my supporters, what kind of Christian are you? He said he asked at Sundance, are you a Nat Turner Christian, or are you a Christian like those who hung him and decapitated him and skinned his body and crushed his flesh to grease? So it seems like in Nat Turner's view of how religion, or specifically the Bible and Christianity, interact with injustice, violence is a non sequitur. Violence has to happen, and you just have to ask yourself, are you a violent Christian on the side of justice, or are you a violent Christian who's using violence to oppress someone and do injustice? And I think that's problematic, but
yes,
I lay all this groundwork to kind of say, I feel like I've opened a couple doors, mainly about how do we confront injustice as Christians, especially something as big as racism or slavery.
Yeah, I think the movie opens those doors. I think that's one of the things the movie, it might be the thing the movie most effectively does, is open that door.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard because I came out of the movie feeling kind of strange, because it, like, the scripture on both sides, as it's portrayed, isn't technically there. It's not like it's almost correct, and like enough to go, yeah, I guess so. But it's not, there are huge chunks of, you know, the liberation found in Jesus,
mm-hmm,
that are missing from the scriptures that are being portrayed for us.
Well, MJ, let's narrow it down a little bit, since, like, I did swing the doors pretty wide. You're talking about how scripture was used in the film to both support and be against slavery. And I think that's one of the problems that non-Christians would throw rocks at Christianity about. They would level these complaints about how the Bible is pro-slavery. So despite the pseudo both sides cherry picking in that, mm-hmm, that I think we see in The Birth of a Nation, what does the Bible say about slavery?
Yeah. So I looked this up a little bit, and I'm a little intimidated with a pastor on the line.
JR is pretty intimidating.
I mean, slavery as America knew it is not slavery as the Bible knew it. It's still not great either way.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not, it's a lot different from my understanding, as far as, you know, it wasn't as much kidnapping people who look different from you and then enslaving them. There was some of that, and there's still, I mean, still some of that today with human trafficking.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's for freedom. Like, that's what Jesus is about, is freedom and, you know, the ability to be made new. And it's hard when you look at slavery and when you look at the slavery that America had enacted on African people, that's not how Jesus operates. And, you know, thankfully he was able to turn that around. You know, I think a lot of Black people came to faith in Jesus because they were enslaved. And that's, you know, that's just, he makes all things work together for his good, right?
Like, yeah, which is tough. Because it's hard to, it's like any terrible thing, or in this case, like incredibly atrocious thing, mm-hmm. to say that slavery could ever be good in and of itself. And that's a pretty deep theological idea. Because we're not, you would have to say, or you'd have to differentiate between saying that like God made slavery happen, or slavery happened and then God tried to redeem things from it. And you know, the verbiage is very important. And before yeah. I trip myself up, I also kind of want to get JR. I want to know what, how would you describe what the Bible has to say about slavery to someone who's not a Christian?
Oh, I mean, I really don't have much problem saying the Bible was written by people who thought it was fine to own slaves, and we know it's not. So, like, the Bible said, like, the Bible thought the earth was flat, and we know it's not. You know, there's plenty of things. The Bible thought women were an inferior gender to men, and we know they're not. Like, there's so many ways in which the scriptures are culturally bound. They're as much as they are fully inspired, they're also fully human, just like Christ. And so they are works of their time, and we have to approach them with wisdom. And we have to be able to look towards what the larger narrative of Scripture is. So when Paul says that he's a slave of Christ, which he says all the time, he's clearly not advocating slavery. He's using a known cultural institution with clear cultural boundaries to establish his relationship to God. Right. He's not saying like, hey, everyone should be slaves. Mm-hmm. MJ brought up a great point. I mean, the reason slavery is so prevalent in the ancient world is because 95% of the population was at or below the subsistence level. And so it was entirely possible, if you were one of those 95% of the people, that you could have a better life if you sold yourself into slavery.
Yeah.
Or a better life for your family. I mean, there were ways it made economic sense, and slavery was rarely racial. The closest you would get to that would be when a nation would conquer another nation and they would take some of the people into slavery. But even then, it wouldn't be everyone. It would be some of those people. And if you want to get real biblical about slavery, the Bible says you have to set your slaves free every 7 years, or every 49 years. I'm sorry, on the Jubilee year, slaves all had to be released, and they had to be given restitutions for the work that they had done when they were your slave. So clearly from the beginning of Scripture, from the book of Exodus, God has had a concern for liberation. Clearly from Genesis, hierarchy is a consequence of the fall. Equality was the plan of Eden. And so that's why, like, pretty much, like, find someone in America who is an abolitionist who did not come to their abolitionist values because of their Christian faith. Like, difficult to find that. And so, yeah, just as much as you had the people who were using the Bible to support a unjust economic system, you had other people who, like Nat Turner, just read the Bible for themselves and thought, you know what? I'm no Bible scholar, but I'm pretty sure this is wrong.
Well, I'm definitely taken aback and pretty upset, JR, that you would say that people wouldn't just know right from wrong and want to abolish slavery because it's objectionally wrong.
Yeah, when you're living on top. Okay, so here's something for real.
Hashtag
that humanism. I have been learning and just seeing more viscerally, which is that when you are in a position of power and privilege, justice is experienced as loss.
Oh yeah, it can look like oppression.
Yeah. And it feels even more important than it looks like it, it feels like it. because in order for things to become equal, if I'm above, that means I have to move down. So mm-hmm. I experience loss. It's good. It's just, it's right, but it doesn't feel good. It doesn't feel just and doesn't feel right to the person in power. And so it's not a surprise to me that people who were benefiting from slavery, even if they didn't own slaves themselves, even if they were the politicians who were getting the money, you know, and all that, the people who were in those positions did everything they could to maintain a slave institution of slavery.
Mm-hmm.
Because it did feel like loss to them. It did feel like they were being oppressed, which is insane, right? I mean, like, from our perspective, but I think it just goes to show when we see people today who are complaining about even talking about things like privilege or saying that now white people are being oppressed or there's reverse racism or all of this insane stuff that people say. Like, it's because the white majority, which is about to be the formerly white, the white former majority, we are experiencing loss because things are becoming more just, more equal. Mm-hmm. And persons of color have a voice where they didn't have a voice before. And we didn't let them have a voice for 400 years. And now we're surprised that when they're able to talk, they're mad. and so the best thing we can do is shut up and quit whining and start listening.
And stop whining.
Because we have a lot to learn. Because we haven't been listening for so long, for 400 years.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No.
End of soapbox.
No, and to build off of that, I mean, look at the two movies named Birth of a Nation. One of them was used as a soapbox to continue that tradition.
Yeah.
So if this is where the film, well, actually, if this is where scripture leaves us, then I'm kind of interested specifically in where you guys landed in the actual film. Like, do you think, and we've already talked about how historically inaccurate the film is about the inciting incident, but do you think that the film did a good or had a good portrayal of scripture's influence in the slavery conversation? Because to me, I felt like the message of the film was that the Bible is confused and contradicts itself.
Really?
Yeah.
That's
how I felt. So I guess throwing that back out. Like, how do you feel that scripture was used in the film? Like, was it, you know, good, bad? Did it effectively communicate what it should have communicated?
I think mostly yes. Like I said or alluded to earlier, you know, you could argue the cherry picking thing from both sides, and no one really truly addresses freedom in Christ, mm-hmm. which I think is a main component of the Bible. But you know, yeah, it's kind of a minor detail they glossed over. But I think for the most part, as far as the messaging that Nate Parker was trying to get across with this movie, which was not that there is freedom in Jesus, but that liberation needs to happen at all costs, I think, yes, he did use the scriptures effectively. And yeah, I think that he ultimately landed on this. This is what the scriptures would want, is freedom for everyone.
Yeah, for me, the pivotal scene was when Nat Turner says, yeah, it says all this stuff, but I've been reading it, and it says all this stuff about freedom, too. And he wasn't saying it like, gosh, which one do you think is right? Because it seems to contradict itself. He was like, no, we all know which one's right. And they have, like, the sense I got from that speech, which was an admittedly minor point. And, Mikey, I think your observation earlier that if they had cut out the rape stuff and spent some more time with his theological development, obviously it probably would have been less marketable to a general audience, but we sure would have been more fascinated by it. Mm-hmm. and it was more historically accurate, again, apparently. But I took that as they are misusing this text. Here is, like MJ said, here's what this text really says. You know, this text is a movement towards liberation. And you know, black preachers forever have been so much better at using the scriptures to call out systemic injustices than white preachers are. And they I think that's right, exactly. Like, because we're like, what systems? We don't see anything because they don't, because we're on top of it all. Right. And they're underneath it looking up, and it, like, it's clear as day to them. And we're kind of on the top looking around being like, nope, clear as far as I could see, you know? So I think I would have liked to have seen more of that, more of Nat Turner talking about how the scriptures invite us towards liberation and call us to tear down the powers and the principalities and all that kind of stuff. But I mean, to me, I didn't walk away thinking that that Nat Turner's take on the scriptures was confused in any way.
Mm. Yeah.
So, well, then I will move the conversation down the road a little bit by saying, if, which seems like we're of the opinion that Nat Turner's view of the scriptures was not in question or in conflict, but very clear, it seems that at least Nate Parker and or Nat Turner in this movie, in this version of history, would see the Christian solution to oppression as basically becoming the earthly instrument of God's wrath. So,
yeah, in the historical account, they called it total war. I mean, you mentioned already the reference of beheading the infant, like, mm-hmm. that. Yeah, like they it was kill every man, woman, and child.
Yeah.
So then, I know we get to do this from like our comfy podcasting chairs, but what do you think the Bible would have us do about oppression in regards to a violent response?
That's the question, isn't it? Right. Yeah, that was the big thing I came away kind of intimidated about talking about it on the podcast, is I was like, this is the biggest question the movie raises, mm-hmm. and I don't know.
I think it's great. That's a great place to start from.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there are examples in the Bible of violent rebellion in the face of oppression. Kind of a lot. And so we treat those as victories, and this one we treat a little muddier, but is it because it's not in the Bible? Is that the only reason why?
Hmm. I guess the question would be, what was the other option, right?
Mm-hmm. That's where I come down. And I'm a very public pacifist. I don't make any bones about that. But as I've gotten older and more cynical, I also have to realize we live in a very imperfect world.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think, again, this is where I thought the movie was really especially commenting heavily on the Black Lives Matter movement. The sense seemed to be, okay, so if we just do nothing, if we just be good and keep our mouths shut, we get killed.
Yeah.
So what are we supposed to do? And I mean, again, gosh, if we can get a little bit political, if you even just like don't stand up during the national anthem, like hard to be more peaceful protesting than that.
Mm-hmm.
They sell T-shirts outside of football games with you in a rifle sight.
Yeah.
So like literally the preferable form of protest that people in power seem to want is no protest. And that's obviously not an option.
Yeah. So. And it recalled, I don't know if you guys saw this image going around the internet. It was around the, oh gosh, I don't remember his name. I feel really bad about this. The black guy that got shot, not Trayvon Martin.
Let me say there's a pretty long.
Yeah. List. Michael Brown.
Yeah. Michael Brown. Is he the one that was in,
Ferguson?
Yes. Yes. So after the Michael Brown verdict came out, where they decided that the cop was not guilty and there was all that rioting, and I saw an image going around the internet, you know, there was looting and a lot of businesses were being broken into and homes and there were broken windows. At least that's what we saw on, you know, our television screens. There was an image going around that said, I care more about broken necks than broken windows. And I remember thinking, sure, but at the same time, what did those business owners have to do with this situation? You know, why should they, you know, this guy's just trying to run a convenience store. Why should he have to now have all this insurance paperwork on his plate because that injustice was done to someone? Does that make sense?
Well, I mean, I would say that that's the pushback answer, right? Like, it's the same things we see with Black Lives Matters thing now. It's like, oh, if Black Lives mattered so much, then why would black on black crime be so high? Or right. If Black Lives Matter was such a peaceful thing, then why is there rioting and looting? Is that the way to get your message across? Yeah, it's the okay, what do you want us to do? We have tried to let the justice system give us justice, but we live in an imperfect world. So the justice system is going to be imperfect no matter who we put in it. So what do you do in the face of overwhelming, and in this case, or this with this topic, systemic oppression and injustice? And
yeah,
as someone who kind of falls in the same camp as JR does, I mean, if you've listened to this podcast for more than, I don't know, one episode, you realize that I'm often arguing for a more pacifist approach to almost every situation. But even mm-hmm. I do not know what the right answer is. You just keep getting beat up, I guess. Like,
right, keep getting killed. I mean, that's...
Yeah.
I mean, I said, big picture, there is a hope that we have that even in death, we are still victorious. You know, that is the freedom in Christ. That's the hope that we have. But, I mean, we're also called to look for the resurrection of this world.
We're not supposed to sit on our hands.
Yeah. So, JR, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, I would just say, like, I cannot in any way begin to imagine criticizing or critiquing Nat Turner, because I can't say what I would do in that situation. Like, mm-hmm. pacifist, like you said, pacifist convictions are super easy to do from the comfort of a podcasting chair.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I mean, the completely ridiculous, oh, you saying so if someone broke in and tried to kill your wife, like, you just let him? Like, no. Like, no one would say that. That's the stupidest thing ever. So that's, if like you're not a pacifist,
is porn art?
Yeah, quit saying that, people. You just make yourself sound stupid. I can't even begin to say that. But yeah, I just don't know. I think what I think is interesting about what the film does, though, is the film points out that he was also unsuccessful. Like, in a way, the violence, it's those who live by the sword die by the sword, and they died by the sword, you know? Like,
well, and he multiplied the violence on black people too. Like, so many black people got murdered after his rebellion ended because he hadn't turned himself in, and just white people were angry.
Yeah.
Well, so as someone taking the pacifist generally approach, it would be the idea, or more proof, that violence basically just begets violence. No one's like, thanks for beating me, now I'm totally okay with you. Like, that's just not how that works. You know, it's why God doesn't use violence to make us his slaves. You know, we are slaves to Christ, but not from violence, not from his wrath. But actually from his grace. And that's why I like that line so much in the film, when he says, when somebody's like, don't forget he's a God of love. And, you know, and it turns like, I won't, nor will I forget he's a God of wrath.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And much like you pointed out, JR, which I think you were just saying that I pointed out, whoever pointed it out, there's this great example that one of my favorite theologians kind of gave as a sermon illustration, talking about God as a God of justice and what it looks like to have hope in a greater justice. Because he said, it's only from, like, you know, suburban America that you can mitigate God's justice, by elevating too highly his love or his grace. Like, God's grace and God's justice are equal in their inability to be measured. Because he said, if you go to like a warring tribe in Africa, a place that not as civilized or as suburban, and you know their women have been raped by a neighboring tribe, their kids have been murdered, their men have been slaughtered or hung or decapitated, it's only in suburban America could we say that God, you know, God's not just or wrathful. God's just loving. Like, if God's not just, if God doesn't have something to balance the scales, then it's not really even love. And that's a tough tension we live in, and it makes it incredibly difficult for us to answer questions like this. Like, who does the violence? You know, who is God's hand? Who does God use?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the movie opens on a Thomas Jefferson quote, which that's already evoking certain thoughts when you see this movie about slavery opening with a Thomas Jefferson quote. But the quote is, "I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, that his justice cannot sleep forever."
Hmm. Felicia,
for me, go ahead.
Good. I would say it's just a lot to wrestle with.
Yeah. Yep.
For me, I think, again, and this is where I would say as a pacifist, like, Walter Wink is the one that says it, I think, best for me. He's like, if a pacifist has to choose between sinning to work towards justice or sinning by allowing justice through an action, you go ahead and sin and stop the injustice, but it's still sin.
Hmm.
And like that's how I would look at something like this. Like,
yeah, I mean, none of this was part of the plan. You know, this wasn't in the initial design.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not. I would hope that when I see injustice, I am provoked to speak up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And not just by calling out an artist who makes myself feel better, but actually doing something tangible about it.
Yeah, I would say, yeah, like primarily, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Primarily by working for good. And man, like, again, I'll just say this. I don't know what percentage of our listener base on this show is white, but I would say if you're white, your main job right now is to listen. You can find a lot of black voices on Twitter and Facebook, and you can follow them and just listen. Don't, even if you disagree, even if they make you super uncomfortable, even if you're like, how can they even say that? Just listen and just keep listening and just keep listening. I've learned so much from my friends who are, Asian American, black, Hispanic, whatever. And then again, from the number of critics and thinkers and, just people that I follow who are different from me. And because, I mean, I'm a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant male. Like I've been in charge since we've had in charge in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And it's good for me to just like, shut up. I have been learning more and more to just speak less and listen. And as much as I can use my platform to give other people a voice. So I think if you're white and you're listening to this and you're puzzling over why we would spend so much time talking about this movie, like you could try that. Just see what happens. Try it for a couple months.
Hmm. Well, and I think that's a good personal call to action or inaction rather, or active listening maybe. You know, maybe call to action. Call to active listening, which I think is really wise. But it lead me to the last question, and this probably does overlap a lot with what you just said, JR. But especially in times like these, since we've already pointed out that the birth of a nation is culturally relevant, What part does God or his church have to play in racial reconciliation? And what could that tangibly look like outside of, like I said, outside of personally listening? Like, can the actual church do something?
Okay, so here's my two cents as someone who's been in a few churches. Most evangelical churches are white churches that have a few minorities who attend, if you're lucky. And most churches in that scenario are what are there's one education scholar who calls that pseudo community. And it's pseudo community because everyone gets along as long as the persons of color basically act white. And you saw this actually on, I don't know if any of you follow Lecrae, the Christian rapper. Mm-hmm. But on July 4th this year, he tweeted a picture of slaves standing in a cotton field. And he said, this was my family on July 4th, 1776.
Cool.
And white Christians lost their minds. And Sean King, who's one of those brilliant black voices that you should absolutely follow and listen to everything he says, he observed all of this and he shared it. And he said, white Christians love Lecrae as long as he doesn't remind them that he's black.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what I mean. Like, so you have this pseudo community in our churches where as long as persons of color just act white, then everything's okay. But as soon as they begin to remind us that they actually don't share our cultural assumptions and that they come from a different perspective and that in fact, their perspective, is a perspective from which it is much easier to see the systems of injustice that we all participate in, we get very uncomfortable with that. And we tell them to be quiet, or we invite them out of our churches, or we marginalize them into various places. And I think that's bad. I think until our white churches can truly follow Jesus to the cross and give up our power and get away from being in control, we aren't going to be able to have serious conversations about race. And again, I think that begins with white people shutting our mouths and listening, because until I can even acknowledge that other people have a different perspective from me, not even that it's a good perspective, just that it is different.
Mm-hmm.
Then the next step is figuring out how to disagree well, which I think if anything 2016 has taught us is that we don't know how to disagree well.
What are you talking about?
I know, right? Yeah. No,
we're
no
recording election. This on the night of the debate.
I know, right? So I mean, we've got so much work to do, and it's like basic kindergarten level stuff. Like the Black Lives Matter systemic evil, that's like calculus, and most of our churches can't even really do arithmetic. And so we're trying to build bridges, but you have to know calculus to build a bridge. You can't build a bridge with arithmetic. And most of us can't even do arithmetic. Like, we can't even be in a room with someone that has a differing political opinion from us and think about sharing communion with them. Like, we have to pretend, like, we just have to imagine that everyone in our churches sees the world the same way we do. Until we get past that, like, we're not going to be able to do anything. So shut up. Learn how to have adult conversations and start talking to people, start listening to people of color. That would be what the church can be doing.
Mm. I was gonna say that does bring up a lot of good stuff. There was an article I know I put in our show notes from Andre Henry, who talked about basically being like a black worship leader in a white church. And he talks about how black and white Christians can be gathered in the same room for worship, but sit a world apart from one another. Just mm-hmm. from the experience, as soon as they like walk out the door. MJ, do you have anything you want to add about the role the church has?
Yeah, I would say don't let that call to inaction that JR is putting out there. I think that's really good. I think that's true, and you know, it is time for us to listen. But I would say don't let that listening turn into actual inaction. And I would mm-hmm. say don't let it turn into this Facebook slacktivism mm-hmm. either.
Mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. where, you know, one like, one share equals a prayer. You know, that's not how it works.
Oh, but that's the best.
Because it's easy. Slogan.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I would say just, you know, make sure you are listening and make sure it is active listening. You know, you listen and you respond. And if you have questions, ask those questions and then step out of the way and let those questions be answered and learn and take notes. And then don't figure it out on your own. Come together with those people in your community and in your church and find out what steps you all need to take to move forward.
Well, I would add to all this and give the ultimate in Sunday school answer, because I think those answers are great. But I think the church's role is to remind people of the gospel. The gospel is the most inclusive message I think the world has ever seen. And like JR mentioned, you know, like the goal of, I believe, the gospel is to put us all on equal footing. And it doesn't matter where you came from. It doesn't matter what, you know, what you've gone through in life, whether you're male or female or white or black or Chinese, like, you are all equally wonderfully loved and accepted in the eyes of Christ. And because of that is a unifying message. And if we believe that, then it's impossible for us to put ourselves in a position of power above someone else. But that's really hard. And I think we've addressed how difficult that is numerous times during this conversation. And it's really a hard message. It's a hard message to preach as people in power, because it's easy to say amen to when you're in power, and it's hard to believe it's true when you're out of power, which, I mean, is what most of us go through most every day anyway. So I think there's great comfort and there's great hope in the message of the gospel for reconciliation, because, like I said, if we truly believe that none of us is better than another, then we can't treat people as like we're better than them. So with the fear that I'm going to talk myself in a circle and be too redundant, as I've known people tell me I might do on occasion, I'd say that we're about at time, because there's a couple more things that we could talk about, but I want to make sure we wrap up in a reasonable amount of time. So with that, I want to give both JR and MJ a chance to give us maybe their, like, a final thought or something, like a favorite scene maybe, or something that really stuck with them that we haven't mentioned. So, MJ, is there anything that we did not mention about the film? Because, like I said, we ended up talking a lot about the film, the things the film talks about or makes us think about, but not specifically about the film. And, you know, that doesn't make it necessarily in and of itself a bad film, but a great conversation starter. So something in the film that you just, that really stuck with you, or was maybe a favorite moment, or something, just a topic that we didn't hit that you wanted to kind of highlight.
Just that the movie's kind of okay. Mm-hmm. It's not that good, actually. I actually felt like, so this is a movie, is a commentary and this, you know, almost borderline mythical allegory for the Black Lives Matter movement. Mm-hmm. And a movie can be that. But I think that a movie like 12 Years a Slave actually gave a better, more rounded portrayal of life as a slave. You know, I don't think the aspiration of Birth of a Nation was to portray slavery as it was, like, as realistically as possible, or even Nat Turner, which is why they don't show him murdering children.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was more to be a conversation starter. And so I think, just if you do go see the movie, maybe temper your expectations, because I was expecting this almost Schindler's List attention to detail historical movie.
Yeah.
And that's not really what it is. It's much artier than that.
I think that's a pretty fair assessment, at least from my experience with the film.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean it's JR's experience. JR.
I liked the movie, I think, more than it seems like maybe you guys did. But that also may be because of how I was reacting to it emotionally. I mean, again, I was just deeply bothered by how thoroughly I related to the good master, you know, and watching how efficiently and effortlessly the film completely skewered him. I don't know. I just found it pretty devastating. And super effective, like super, super, super effective. So, I think it's, I just walked out of the movie thinking about a lot, and it stayed with me for several days. And it's one that I've been anxious to talk about with you guys. I have several friends that I've kind of poured over with it. I've had a couple of friends that I've just sort of sat with, and we've just been like, yeah, so that movie, and then we just kind of sit together.
Mm-hmm.
And like, don't say much, you know, I mean, cause it's, I don't know. I don't know that I could even effectively comment on its quality because it messed with me. It made me think about a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Well,
I definitely think that's, I mean, the entire reason we're having this conversation now, or we're even recording an episode, on it because, like I said, I maybe it was because my expectations were so high, much like MJ's, you know, I'm expecting it to be wonderful attention to detail, finally telling this story in film form, and then just kind of falling so short of those expectations. But regardless of what I thought about it technically or historical, you know, about its historical accuracy, it definitely is one of the most conversation inciting films that I have seen mm-hmm. all year.
Yeah.
I mean, even most films that I've seen that I even think start good conversations typically only start like one, maybe two good conversations, at least that I've seen in 2016. And that's evidenced by the conversations we've been having this year so far on the podcast. But the four or five questions that we've kind of mulled over, kind of poked around at, even just surface levels in this conversation tonight, are conversations that you could sit and have with people all night, just on one of those conversations, just about how the Bible deals with slavery. How does the Bible deal with oppression? How does the Bible deal with violence? How do white people interact with black people? How do white people interact with being in a culture that honestly skews towards favoritism in almost anything that they want? Why is it that people always tend to come to them? How is it that this movie seems to be such a great reminder and or almost like an allegory, like MJ said, about what's going on today? How does this movie show how everything that's been going on has been going on for a long time? What do we do with art? How do we separate it from the artist? How do we, you know, at what point does the historical accuracy of a film matter before we dismiss anything else that's in the film? So, like, there's so many great film topic conversations that you can take from this. There's so many great social topic conversations you can take, racial, theological, interpersonal, you know, like there's just a lot that this film kicks up. And again, like I said, I'd still agree with MJ, maybe temper your expectations, but if you go see this with a friend and you don't have a conversation with them after, then you've missed an opportunity.
Or you're traumatized.
Not necessarily directly after, but at some point.
I was not in a talking mood after I finished this film.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I watched it with my wife and we were kind of like, and we didn't talk about it till basically the next day. You know, we're kind of like, well, how about that movie? So, but like I said, it puts it out there. It puts everything up on Front Street. So you got to kind of deal with it. because things still go up on Front Street, where I'm from. But what I want to know from you guys, the listeners, is some of the basic questions we ask. Where do you land on supporting questionable artists' art, and how does that differ from, you know, supporting their personal life? Like, I know that's like a almost like a personal decision or a personal conviction at this point. So I'm curious where you guys land on that. If you have any complaints about JR's particular views on the Bible's culturally influenced errors, please direct all those to JR.
At JR Forsteris on Twitter.
There you go. And
come at me.
And if I'm also interested to know what you guys think, the listeners, think about what the church can do, or what role the church has in specifically racial reconciliation, but just in times like these, like what can we as believers do? What role do we have? What responsibility do we have? And what opportunities do we have? So I would love to hear any discussion that gets started on that. And speaking of discussions, I've really enjoyed this one. I think it's one of the harder discussions we've had to have on the podcast that we've had the privilege of having. And I think great discussions, like usual, happen because we have great guests. So I want to give these guys both a chance to give you places where you can follow their work or follow them personally. So MJ, what is it you do around the web? How can people follow you, and how can people follow your work?
Sure. Well, I have a podcast, I have a YouTube show, I have a blog, and all of it lands on the blog. So the blog is thatrealperspective.blogspot.com. We go by Real Perspective, but we don't have a URL yet. Podcast lands there, YouTube lands there. Podcast you can find on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Beyond Pod. If you're an Android user, it's called the Before and After Show. YouTube, if you just want to watch me, is on YouTube under the Before and After Show. You can follow me on Twitter at MJSmith891, and I think that's it. And sometimes I write on Real World Theology.
Yes. Probably the most important thing that you do.
Yep.
Maybe clearly, personally. By the way he framed those all up, that was definitely...
Yeah, it was building towards the climax.
Yeah.
Especially because I've written two things in 4 months for Real World Theology.
Probably the two best things on the site, maybe besides anything JR wrote. which would be equal.
Killer Magnificent Seven review, man.
Nailed it! So speaking of the things that you do around the internet, JR, I am under the impression there are one or two things. So what are those things, and how can people get a hold of you and direct their complaints towards you?
Basically, I just podcast. If you tweet at me, I'll get it probably within the month. So yeah, all my podcasts you can find at NorvalRogers.com/podcasts. Norval Rogers is the blog that I co-host with my Storymen friends, that I podcast with. And that is Shaggy from Scooby-Doo's real name. If you can't figure out how to spell it, just Google that and you'll be able to find us. So.
Well, excellent. Please guys, make sure you're checking out what, MJ and JR are doing. They are doing lots of really great things. Things that if you listen to this podcast, you will probably be very interested in the things that their work touches on as well. You can follow me at Fizzification on Twitter. Sadly, much like JR, I don't use it enough for it to be super effective, but I do share quite a bit on there. As always, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast if you've enjoyed it a little, even just a little bit. And please, please, please review the show. Leave us some feedback. You know, help bump our rankings and help give more 5-star reviews. It's just incredibly, incredibly helpful. I'm exceedingly, especially again on this because of this episode and because of the nature of the topic, exceptionally grateful for our excellent guests. So please, again, follow them. I am very, very thankful to you listeners for taking time to make us a part of your week, because there are lots of things you can do with your week and you give us a little slice of your time. I am very appreciative of that. So I remind you that until next episode, please remember, story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!
My two dreams are a parody Twitter account run against me, mm-hmm. and which I guess I would have to tweet more for that to be realistic, and Twitter would have to be a thing that still mattered, and then like a website dedicated to hating me. That's how you know you made it.
Mm. Oh, the Driscoll rap.
But if you actually looked up any of the people on his list, they were like for real heretics. Like not like internet heretics today, like yeah. for real actual heretics that did not, they didn't even believe what Baptists believe.
Not I was like internet heretics.
Yeah. So that could be your episode, The Birth of a Nation and Internet Heretics.